Last week, we began our study of Exodus 21, talking about that beginning portion of it relating to slavery and all the issues with that. We talked about their system and how its system differed markedly from the more, quote, modern system of slavery, which we have seen in the last few hundred years, whereas theirs was more like indentured servitude than it was like the chattel slavery which we had in this country and in most of the Western world in recent time. And so there actually were rules involved with their slavery, and they were rules that really tried to respect the people who were slaves as human beings. We'll see some more of that in this section, but this section is not primarily about slavery anymore, but rather it's about murder. In a sense, it is deriving from that one of the Ten Commandments, which says, "Thou shalt not kill." I must admit, my first temptation of looking at this was to say, yep, okay, murder's God's against it, let's move on. But then I started doing research into what our world is like nowadays, and so I realized that there is a lot that we can say about this. But before we begin saying anything about it, let's get into the text and let's figure out what God has to say. Exodus chapter 21, starting at verse 12. "He who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. But if he did not lie in wait for him, but God let him fall into his hand, then I will appoint you a place to which he may flee. If, however, a man acts presumptuously toward his neighbor so as to kill him craftily, you are to take him even from my altar that he may die." This is incorporated into our legal system. It is the difference between first-degree murder, second-degree murder, and manslaughter. Actually, here, second-degree murder and manslaughter are really combined into one category. First-degree murder, no matter where you went to, no matter where you fled to, even if it were to the very altar of God, you were to be pried off the altar of God, and you were to be taken care of. You were not to be allowed to go away from that. However, if it was an accidental or a non-premeditated murder, for example, if somebody was involved in a fight, and one of the people fell down, hit his head on a rock, and died, that was not first-degree murder. In that case, there were cities of refuge to which the person could flee. The cities of refuge were places of sanctuary where, so long as he stayed in the city of refuge, he was safe. The relatives of the deceased were not allowed to pursue him there, to act on injustice, to bring vengeance to him. But if he left the city, all bets were off. God appointed these things even in the book of Deuteronomy, where we saw down in Deuteronomy chapter 4, even on the east bank of the Jordan, God appointed some of these cities because it was important that if you had accidentally or non-intentionally killed someone, that it was important to get there as fast as you could, because there would be people gunning for you. And so you had to get out of town fast and get to one of those cities. So even God made a distinction between these different kinds of murder involved with someone who was died at your hands. They were all serious, but premeditated murder was quite different. Verse 15, "He who strikes his father or his mother shall surely be put to death." There is no premeditation about this. There is not, in fact, any murder involved here, but I believe this is also involved just assault, serious assault of any sort, because it gets even better down below in a couple verses that even goes further than this, that the relationship between parents was to be sacred, we're not talking about a little kid slapping his mother or his father. We're talking about a child, an adult child or an older child, that is assaulting a parent, and we call it nowadays elder abuse or something like that, where someone is actually striking with intent to the father or mother. So it's different than just a little child. But if someone were to do that, then the sentence was death. Verse 16, he who kidnaps a man, whether he sells him or he is found in his possession, shall surely be put to death. Sort of interesting that when you read about their system of slavery, it was mostly voluntary of a sort, voluntary on someone's behalf. Either the person would sell himself or herself into slavery because of a debt that needed to be paid, or the family would sell someone into slavery, but you didn't have the system that we had where you would just kidnap someone and enslave them. That was not how it worked. That here in this case, kidnapping was also a capital offense. No matter what you did, you weren't allowed to kidnap someone. Verse 17, he who curses his father or his mother shall surely be put to death. And once again, that was in an older or an adult child who would levy a curse upon father or mother. That was, once again, tying into another one of the commandments, isn't it? Honor your father and your mother. So here we have not only thou shalt not kill, but honor your father or your mother. Okay. So I guess the next question is, well, okay, what constitutes really a death at your hands? A lot of the law is an exposition of the Ten Commandments, and the Ten Commandments are really an exposition of the two great commandments. Love your Lord your God with your whole heart, body, mind, and strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. And all of the law and the commandments are really an exposition of that. Verse 18, if men have a quarrel and one strikes the other with a stone or with his fist, and he does not die but remains in bed, if he gets up and walks around outside on his staff, then he who struck him shall go unpunished. He shall only pay for his loss of time and shall take care of him until he is completely healed. Notice it doesn't ask here who hit first. It doesn't say who punched first. If you cause injury to somebody else, then you are responsible for taking care of that person until the injury is healed. Of course, this is really an unjust injury. It's not referring to the case of someone, for instance, breaking into your house and you shoot them in the leg. You're not responsible for taking care of them until they are healed. This is rather something where there is a conflict, out in the parking lot, somebody gets in an argument, two young men get in an argument, fists fly, someone falls back against a rock or a pole and breaks an arm or breaks a hand, so that person can't walk, can't work. Well, guess what? The person who was involved in the fight, who caused the injury, is responsible for that person until he is healed. Verse 20, if a man strikes his male or female slave with a rod and he dies at his hand, he shall be punished. Their system of slavery had rules. They had some serious rules. Rule number one is that male or female slaves are human beings, that you don't just go ahead and kill them. They're not property, they're not animals, you don't kill them, you'll get punished if you do that. If, however, he survives a day or two, no vengeance shall be taken, for he is his property. In other words, there's a benefit of the doubt there. Yeah, well, maybe it was a different injury, or maybe it was something that wasn't related to that injury. So they're allowed to survive and not take the penalty. Verse 22 has been misread. If men struggle with each other and strike a woman with child, that she gives birth prematurely, yet there is no injury, he shall surely be fined as the woman's husband may demand of him, and he shall pay as the judges decide. But if there is any further injury, then you shall appoint as a penalty life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, bruise for bruise. This is not talking about miscarriage here. This is talking about premature birth. Two men are fighting, a woman gets in between. Nowadays, I guess, two women fighting. And as a result, the woman gives birth prematurely, who's pregnant, and the child is born normally. There is no problems. There's no problems with her. Everything goes along fine. Then the husband of the woman who gave birth prematurely might ask for a fine because of the trouble caused. But if no harm is done to the baby or the mother is implied, then no further penalty is assessed, only a fine. If, however, an injury occurs to the baby or the mother, then you fall into the penalties for any other kind of injury. Some people look at this and they say, well, this justifies abortion. It does not. It does not, because the clear implication here is we're talking about premature birth. We're not talking about the death of a child. We're not talking about the death of a baby here. This thing, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, some people take this to be very harsh, but it really isn't, because what it is doing is it is setting the maximum penalty that can be enforced. In other words, somebody hits somebody else so that person is blinded. The relatives of that person do not have the right to kill the person who did that. Right? It was setting a limit on the punishment. Some people interpret this, and I kind of like that interpretation, to mean that if somebody's eye gets taken out, that means that you have to be their eyes, that you have to provide for them, is one rabbinic interpretation of it that I think actually makes some sense. Hand for hand, if somebody's hand gets damaged by your efforts, that doesn't necessarily mean that therefore that person can demand that your hand get chopped off or broken, but it could mean that that means that your hand is responsible for helping that person and supplying the need that their own hand could no longer supply. Verse 26 and 27 is interesting. Once again, we have limits on what they could do to slaves. If a man strikes the eye of his male or female slave and destroys it, he shall let him go free on account of his eye. If he knocks out a tooth of his male or female slave, he shall let him go free on account of his tooth. Now, this is not just talking about eyes and teeth. This is talking about the most serious injury you can do that is permanent, that does not include death, that's blinding someone, all the way down to something which is a knocking out of a tooth, which is something that is an injury that is serious but not life-threatening or won't change somebody's lifestyle, really. So it really implies anything in between, any permanent injury that a slave owner did to a slave, anything that did not heal, meant that the slave went free. So it was a limit on what a slave owner could do to the slaves in their system. So you didn't have the ridiculous abuses that we had in our country of people cutting off arms and legs and feet of slaves in order to teach them a lesson. That was not allowed under their system. Verse 28. If an ox gores a man or a woman to death, the ox shall surely be stoned, and his flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall go unpunished. In other words, if an ox kills someone else, then the ox dies and you gain no profit from it. You don't get to eat it. You're out an ox. You don't sell it to the butcher. You don't eat it. You don't keep the meat. You don't get any products from it. The ox is done. Verse 29, if, however, an ox was previously in the habit of goring and its owner has been warned, yet he does not confine it and it kills a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and its owner also shall be put to death. If a ransom is demanded of him, then shall give for the redemption of his life. Whatever is demanded of him, whether it gores a son or a daughter, it shall be done to him according to the same rule. The ox gores a male or female slave, the owner shall give his or her master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned. So basically, there are other places in the Torah where it talks about this, but the principle is death by negligence. You are culpable if you knew something was a problem and you didn't do anything about it. You don't have a lot of oxen around nowadays, but if you have a car that you know the brakes aren't very good and you don't do anything to fix it, and you're driving one day and the brakes fail and you run down a pedestrian or you kill somebody or hurt somebody, guess what? It's your fault. You procrastinated, you knew there was a problem, and you did nothing about it. You did nothing about it. Somebody knows that a product is faulty. Maybe you work for an employer, you know the product is faulty, it's going to hurt someone. But yet you say nothing and you do nothing, and it kills someone, guess what? You're liable. A lot of our law comes from that. That saying nothing and doing nothing is not an excuse. You can be guilty by doing nothing just as you can be guilty by doing something. You need to be active and you need to stand forth and do something. Verse 33, if a man opens a pit or digs a pit and does not cover it over, once again, negligence, and an ox or a donkey falls into it, the owner of the pit shall make restitution, he shall give money to its owner, and the dead animal shall become his. One man's ox hurts another so that it dies, then they shall sell the live ox and divide its price equally, and also they shall divide the dead ox. Or if it is known that the ox was previously in the habit of goring, yet its owner has not confined it, he shall surely pay ox for ox, and the dead animal shall become his. In other words, if you didn't know that the ox was a problem, it was a good-natured ox that all of a sudden decided to kill another ox, then the two of you, you and the guy whose ox had gored, you divide both oxen, sell the meat, and you're done. But if you knew this ox was a problem, you knew that it was going to hurt other animals, but you still didn't confine it, you let it run loose, then you're liable for it, and that, congratulations, you just owned yourself, you just bought yourself a dead animal. You just own yourself a dead animal. But there is no recompense for you. However, it's assumed that the animal that it killed is able then to be sold, and you know the meat be used from it, but the animal that had done it, that caused the problem, was to be stoned. You aren't allowed that to run free. So what are we to make of this today? What are we to make of this today? Like I said, I first read this, my first reaction was, yeah, murder, God's against it, let's move on. So what really is our really state of being as far as our world nowadays, and particularly our country? What is the leading cause of death for young people between the ages of 10 and 24? The most leading cause of death in that age group is motor vehicle accidents. Second leading cause of death is violence. It's murder, homicide, domestic violence, and that sort of thing. Homicide is the second leading cause of death for adolescents and young adults. We got a problem. We got a big problem. I mean, this is not something that you can assume that we're a civilized society, that we can just say, well, you know, like sort of like that protected kind of isolated dilemma to say, who would think to murder anybody else? Well, the answer apparently is lots and lots of different people. Lots and lots of different people. There has been a slight decline in homicide rates. However, they are still very, very high. In the year of 2007, which is the last year that I think that I got information on, 5,764 young people aged 10 to 24 were murdered, an average of 16 each day. I think that's talking about the United States. Over 656,000 physical assault injuries in young people aged 10 to 24 were treated in the United States emergency room in 2008. In 2009 nationwide survey, about 32% of high school students reported being in a physical fight in the 12 months before the survey. An estimated 20%, that's 1 in 5 high school students, reported being bullied on school property in 2009. Okay, so there's a lot of issues with violence among young people. Who is the particular group that is best represented in terms of the number of people who have who have been victims of homicide here in Maryland? That was the United States. Now let's talk about Maryland. In Maryland, looking at percentage of homicides, people who are aged 18 through 24 were about 33% of all the homicides. That's 1 in 3. And add to that those between 25 and 34, and that's another 30%. So now about 63% of the victims of homicide were between the ages of 18 and 34. In terms of gender, the victims, now we're talking about we're not talking about perpetrators here, we're talking about victims. The victims were overwhelmingly male. 87% of the victims of homicide were male in the state of Maryland. And in terms of racial, the overwhelming majority were black. That was, in 2005, 76% of all homicide victims were black. 22% were white, and 2% were other races, probably Latino, Hispanic, Asian, whatever. So it's a problem. It is a very, very big problem. There were, in terms of the total number of homicides in Maryland in 2005, there were 552. Now, if you kind of work backwards from that and watch the news every night and know how many homicides there are in Baltimore City, then you understand that more than half of the homicides in all of Maryland are committed in Baltimore City, which probably explains the racial backdrop because of the racial makeup of Baltimore City, and that's where the crime is. Okay? And so that's what you're going to get, the murders, and that's the groups that are going to be affected. What are the leading cause of homicides? Where does it come from? What's particularly involved with it? Well, I think we can guess. There are really two things that are really the cause of it. Thing number one, the risk factors, is drugs. I mean, drugs is a very big factor in homicides. They are, and of course, once again, drug traffic is rampant in the city, and so that's causing a lot of the homicides and the murder. Another thing that we might have exposure to that would cause homicides is what's called intimate violence. That's something with boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, wife, ex-wives, ex-boyfriends, ex-girlfriends. And that is something that actually has gone down a little bit, but that is something that is still an issue that people have to be aware of. That is something that if you're not involved in Baltimore City, but you're involved in any kind of counseling or working with people, that is a particular danger. That is predominantly something that is that affects women more than men, although men are still involved by it. That men still are involved. They're still killed by wives, ex-wives, girlfriends, or whatnot. The weapon of choice varies. The women, believe it or not, in the intimate homicide kinds of things, there is a very high proportion that girlfriends and wives that tend to be killed just by force, abuse, but firearms are a part of that. Husbands and ex-husbands tend to be killed by firearms, but there is a higher percentage there of knives than guns. And women tend to use knives more than guns than men do. We got a problem. We got a problem with people killing people. Since it is so high up with adolescents, we have a big problem with young people killing young people. We could kind of stick our heads in the sands and say, woo, 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 I can't hear you, and it's going to go away. It's absolutely amazing how casual you get with it when you're looking at the news and they report a homicide in Baltimore City and you think to yourself, that's not news. Like, you get one of those pretty much every night. But you got to break through that inoculation against violence to understand how terrible that is. That God really hates the taking of a life. I mean, it's God, the commandments he gave to Noah back in Genesis chapter 6. One of the reasons why he brought the flood is because the earth was filled with violence. Genesis chapter 9, he says that God said that whoever sheds man's blood by man's hand, his blood will be shed. It's something that is one of the primary commandments of God, is not to kill. Not to kill. And I haven't even begun talking about the abortion issue, the abortion horror that we have going on, where we think nothing about killing children before they're born. I mean, even to the point of restricting, trying to restrict even the ability of women to understand and see what it is that they are killing. That there's all these efforts that are being brought about to shield women from understanding what it is that they're doing, to couch it in all these pleasant terms, that we are a murderous, bloodthirsty sort of people. I mean, even you look at our entertainment. Our entertainment is just absolutely wild as far as the bloodthirstiness and the rampant murders and the mayhem that's going on. That we think nothing of it. Shootings and all the rest of it. Surprisingly, we are not the most violent country in the world when you look at the proportion of murders per capita. We are, I think, down on number 12. It's nothing to be proud of, but we're not up there in number 1 or 2. But we're still pretty awful. Most of the issues in our country, it's kind of funny because I remember many years ago I was corresponding with someone in Germany over a computer program I'd written and was trying to market, and he was helping me translate the instructions to German. And just their idea of what life was like in America was sort of like the Wild West, where shootouts were occurring on every street every day. And just walk down the street, you find yourself getting murdered, and it's not like that. Most of the violence, and I had statistics somewhere that I probably left on the chair at home, is that most of the murders occur in large cities. In cities, I think the worst, the city where the murder rates have not gone down is, I think, from population of 250 to like a million, in that kind of large but not super large city. That's one of the worst issues. And we are just on the doorstep of one of those places. Unfortunately, too many people outside in the county sort of have the idea that, well, that's Baltimore City. It's almost like a different planet. That there's almost like a wall around Baltimore City, and that the people in the county don't have to worry about what goes on there. But you ought to be. You ought to be concerned. Besides mere concern over your fellow men, it's like, how can you just ignore something that's occurring just 2 miles down the road or 4 miles down the road? It's like an easy walking distance. It's something we have to deal with. So what is the people have tried all sorts of things from a human perspective in order to try to deal with all these issues of murder and violence and all the associated things that come from it. People have tried all sorts of more restrictive gun regulations, but it doesn't work. It doesn't work. When you look at these age groups and the guns they're using, it's already illegal for them to carry them. They're not. It's against the law for them to conceal carry. It's against the law for people under age 21 to possess a handgun. Yet you have people that are 18, 19, 20 years still using handguns in the commission of a crime. So that does not seem to be working. All sorts of other things that have been tried, all sorts of other initiatives, doesn't work. So you've got to ask yourself, what in the world is going to work? The basic issue is not the externals. And we talked about that briefly with the Ten Commandments, talking about Yeshua's commandments, that if you call someone fool in your heart, that you've already committed murder. That really the act of murder begins with intent. It begins with somebody's heart. In order to bring down the violence rate, in order to bring down the murder rate, it's not so much as keeping people from weapons, because I thought it was kind of interesting. I don't have the chart ready, but in rural areas, poisoning is one of the ways we'll kill other people. I shouldn't laugh, but it's like, If you take the weapon, one weapon away, they'll figure out another weapon to use. If you take the guns away, they'll use knives. You take the knives away, they'll use sticks. If you take the sticks away, they'll poison or just beat somebody with their fists. It's their hearts that need to be changed. And we need to get out there. We need to teach people about the love of God. We need to give people hope. A lot of these things are arising from hopelessness. Why are poverty and violence going together? It's because poverty engenders a sense of hopelessness, a sense of being less than a full-fledged human being, of having nothing to look for, nothing to hope for, nowhere to go and nothing to do, that somebody who's not any value, so why not just engage in violence? And so with hope, you gotta give people hope. You give people hope by standing beside them. You don't give people hope by tying it to a rock and throwing it over the wall, over the city limits. You gotta give people hope by working with them. I don't have any easy answers on how to do it, but government programs aren't the answer, because government programs don't change people's hearts. We need to get in there as the people of God, and we need to really reach people. We've got to work with people. We've got to mentor people. We've got to, especially the young people. The young people there have been teaching, have been taught all sorts of ridiculous things in school as far as mankind and about their place in it. Just reach out to the young people and just put your arms around them and try to get them to understand who God is and what their place is, that they are valuable to God, that they are loved by God, that they have a chance to succeed, even if success means raising a family and just, you know, doing what's right. They can be a success at that. They don't have to have $1 million. They don't have to have a fancy car and jewelry and all the rest of the things. That they can be a success in the small, quiet places of their lives. It's a tough thing to do. But the violence, even though we ourselves aren't taking out guns and shooting each other, that violence affects us. Violence affects us. And if we see somebody who's at risk, it's sort of interesting to watch some of my son's friends as they're growing up. Because sometimes you almost say to yourself, as you see a kid that's in his middle school years, kind of on the periphery, saying, "Oh, that kid's most likely, you know, most likely to wind up in jail." And the strange thing is, now that they're teenagers, some of that's coming to pass. They are winding up in jail. They are winding up doing drugs and doing other things. I mean, it's not infrequent for my son to say, "Oh, you know, remember so and so I went to school with, and you remember this, you know, went to middle school, you remember this gangly middle school kid who is, you know, just hanging out and trying to learn what it takes to succeed in the world, and oh yeah, he's in jail. And you know, this other kid that, you know, this other gangly kid who, was maybe the class clown or whatever, oh yeah, he's in jail for doing this, and this other guy's in jail for doing that, and this other guy's bouncing back and forth." So don't think it can't happen to the people you're working with. Don't think it can't happen to people in your family or people in your neighborhood. It can. It can. And if you watch somebody who's turning down the wrong path, and you're there, and you can lend a hand, jump in, do what you can. There are times when you can't do anything. But you should at least pray. Pray for these people. And say, "Lord, you know, I see this child, or I see this man, or I see this woman, that things are happening here, that this is not going to end well." The other side of the coin, I talked a little about violence between intimates, boyfriends, girlfriends, spouses, ex-spouses. Those things, unless they are treated, unless they are handled well, they will end in increasing violence, and they will end in murder. Somebody starts abusing a spouse, escalating pattern of violence. It's nothing to deceive yourself about, that it's going to go away or it's going to somehow magically improve. It's not. It's not. The pattern is clear. There's a spiral, a downward spiral. Unless the abuser gets help, unless the abuser gets counseling, that is serious counseling and serious help, and makes a serious commitment to change, namely come to know the Lord, or something that they have done or said that you know that they have changed their ways, that you are in danger and you need to leave to a place of safety until something can be done to help. That's something that, whether or not you're in that situation, that's something that you should tell all of your friends, that if there's somebody at work or somebody in your family that is under those conditions of asking, "What should I do?" the counselor should be, get out of the house and try and get your spouse to get counseling and work this out, because otherwise you're in danger. You're in danger. Part of that goes from that, remember what I said, that inaction can be just as bad as action. If you see a situation happening that's going to result in violence, you're going to result in even murder, and you do nothing, then you share responsibility in what's going on. That you need to get involved when something is clearly dangerous. I'm not saying be a busybody and start poking into people's relationships and seeing how it's going, but people at work talk, or people in your neighborhood talk, or people in the family talk. They'll take you aside and say, "Hey, I want to talk to you about, you know," or "How are things going at home?" And they say, "Oh, you know," and they are evasive, or they're vague, and you know something bad's happening, or they show up at work, or they show up at family gatherings bruised, and they always have a different excuse for why they're bruised. Don't be stupid. You know, delve into it and find out what's going on. That we can get involved. We can't fix it all. We really can't. There's no magic program, there's no magic pill that's going to fix this. But we can try to turn the tide one person at a time. See what we can do. And God is powerful. And God can turn around the most hopeless of situations. And He can make turn people's hearts. And it's up to us to be His agent, to allow Him to work through us, to see what He can actually do in people's lives. Let's pray. Dearest God and Father, thank You for all the opportunities You've given to us to minister to people, to help them through. Father, first of all, keep our hearts pure, that we should never be tempted to murder or be involved in violence, but even beyond that, that we should be lights to all those around us, that we should be able to turn the tide of violence wherever we can, whether it's in an individual or a neighborhood or even a whole city or a whole state, that You might open up our eyes, that we might see where we might be effective and we might be used for You in the lives of other people, for their benefit, but more importantly, for Your glory and the glory of our Messiah, Yeshua. Amen.